Trump goes after Catholic charities and child migrants. Students go after their college's immigration cop agreements, and activists go after climate change's effects. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll talk with Miami's Roman Catholic Archbishop Thomas Wenske about the Trump administration's erasure of a program to aid unaccompanied child migrants and the papal presidential quarrel behind it. We'll also examine a growing movement on Florida college campuses to rescind cooperation deals with federal immigration agencies. And we'll discuss a new WLRN documentary that casts South Florida as a national climate resilience model. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. The growing rift between President Trump and the Roman Catholic Church over immigration policy, but also Pope Leo XIV's criticisms of the Iran war, has landed in Miami. In what many see as Trump-style retribution for the church's stances, the Trump administration has abruptly canceled an $11 million contract with the nonprofit Catholic Charities here, an arrangement that for decades has aided unaccompanied child migrants, including the Cuban Pedro Pan kids of the 1960s. The administration insists it's backing out because, under Trump's strict immigration enforcement agenda, there simply aren't as many unaccompanied migrant children in the country as there once were. But Miami's Catholic Archbishop, Thomas Wenske, calls that a short-sighted and, quote, baffling outlook. Either way, it comes in an especially fraught week of religious feuding, with Trump depicting himself as Jesus in a controversial meme, and Vice President J.D. Vance lecturing the Pope about theology. Joining me now is Miami's Catholic Archbishop Thomas Wenske. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup, Your Excellency.
Good to be back with you, Tim.
The Catholic Charities Shelter for Unaccompanied Migrant Minors is the Monsignor Brian O. Walsh Children's Village in Palmetto Bay. But the Catholic Charities aid to unaccompanied migrant children here has an almost 70-year history, starting with those 14,000 Pedro Pan kids who were flown out of Cuba in the 1960s. Remind us of the history of this program, which has obviously mattered a lot to an immigrant community like this, that you fear the Trump administration is effectively shutting down.
Well, it is shutting it down. And, of course, this was a program that started with Pedro Pan in the early 60s and has continued uninterrupted since that time. Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Miami has been contracting with the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is an agency of HHS, which is which is charged by the government to seek the best interests of the child in placing them when those children, unaccompanied children, are turned over to HHS and then ORR. Basically, when they come across the border, ICE or Border Patrol are not supposed to hold the kids. They're supposed to turn them over to HHS, and HHS, through Office of Refugee Resettlement, brings them to Catholic Charities or other agencies around the country. We've been doing this for almost 70 years, as you noted, and we've been the premier agency. We've done it in a very stellar fashion, yeah, as the Pedro Pan people can testify. And here's the legacy agency, and an agency that has been doing a tremendous job, all of a sudden losing its funding. And some of that funding is assigned to other agencies, so it's not going. Any money allocated is going to other agencies, but agencies that don't have necessarily the same track record of excellence that we have. Now, why is this happening? I think it's a coincidence that this is happening at the same time that there's this dust up between the Pope and the President.
And I want to get to that. But the Trump administration, though, says it's canceling this contract because the president's immigration crackdown has rendered it unnecessary, that there aren't as many unaccompanied migrant children in the country now to merit this service. But the Miami Herald editorial page today asked what I and a lot of others are asking: has the administration shown evidence that the numbers are down enough to warrant discontinuing this aid? For example, how many are in the Walsh shelter currently?
Yes, and well, right now, those that were in the shelter have been transferred by order of our OOR to other agencies that provide essentially the same services that we do. But as I said, they don't have the same track record that we have.
Right.
Not to cast any aspersions on them, but we've been doing it for a long time, and we've been doing it very well. So it's not that the money disappeared; it's the money has been reallocated to other places. And it is true that the number of unaccompanied minors is down, but over the past 60, 70 years, those numbers have always fluctuated.
Sure.
From the 1960s, it was big with the Pedro Pan. Then in the early 80s, it was big because a lot of Haitian children were involved. But there's always been kids from all different nationalities, and it expands and contracts over the years. And in fact, in the past, when we had almost no children at that shelter, OR says, keep it open because we want those slots to be reserved for us.
Right. Archbishop, just out of curiosity, is there an estimate of how many children over these more than 60 years center has helped?
I haven't counted them, but it's in the thousands.
Right.
Again, starting with the 14,000.
Sure. Yeah.
It came in the early 60s, so it's in the thousands.
And
our, the shelter that we have there has capacity for 81.
Time. Now, in a Miami Herald op-ed this week, you called the Trump administration's cancellation of this program, quote, baffling, because it would be very hard for the government to replicate what Catholic Charities has created here, quote, if and when future waves of unaccompanied minors reach our shores. So you feel it's a good bet that we are going to see new waves of unaccompanied migrant children in the future?
Well, just because of where we are. And I think Congressman Jimenez said the same thing in a letter that he wrote asking for reconsideration of this decision, mm-hmm. saying that, because of where we are, with the situation in Cuba, the ongoing crisis in Haiti, the Caribbean, et cetera, we have to be prepared, and like I said in the past, even when the numbers were down, ORR wanted to keep us ready and open so as to be able to absorb quickly any exodus of children.
Right. All it takes is another earthquake or a war south of
exactly.
our borders to create, to have to recreate this from scratch would be quite an effort.
I don't know you might not remember, but in the waning days of the Biden administration, you had people like Governor Abbott in Texas and even Governor DeSantis in Florida accusing Catholic Charities, generically Catholic Charities, of being in cahoots with the cartels in Mexico, that we were actually collaborating with them and bringing unaccompanied minors into the country, which is a total falsehood, a calumny, because our contracts have been exclusively with ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement.
You pointed out at a press conference yesterday that unaccompanied migrant children, almost by default, have suffered some sort of psychological, if not physical, trauma, which makes a refuge like the Catholic Charities program here all the more urgent. What sort of trauma do we usually find among these kids, many of whom, as you pointed out, have undergone long and dangerous odysseys alone to get here?
Listen, in the past, we've had 12-year-old girls that were pregnant that were turned over to our custody. So that tells you something about the trauma.
Yeah.
You can't walk across Mexico without experiencing some trauma, especially if you're a vulnerable child.
Right, especially on things like what do they call that train that carried
right.
so many unaccompanied migrant children? It was the Beast. It was called
La Bestia.
So, but the psychological trauma, you said, is particularly acute among these children.
Psychological and And people have suffered physical traumas too, loss of limbs because of falling out of trains, falling into pits, automobile accidents, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, these children have special needs and they require some specialized attention.
Right.
Again, people will say, well, why bother? Well, you know, legislatively, Congress has decided that ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, should take care of these children when they are turned over by the immigration authorities. And in doing so, they should seek the best interest of the child. So it's not a question of just warehousing them until they can figure out where to deport them or whatever. It's a question of doing what's best for the child, because when all is said and done, we're talking about children.
But you also pointed out that now, without the kind of help Catholic Charities in partnership with the federal government was providing, those unaccompanied migrant children who are in fact here have, as you put it, still, quote, have difficult journeys ahead of them in the immigration legal system. What further trauma might they now face, and how do the Church and the Catholic Charities plan to pivot now in order to help them in that regard?
Well, you know, we've been assisting these children in the past through our Catholic legal services. Our lawyers have been representing those children, as well they represent other candidates or other clients that are in need of immigration services. So we still, you know, we'll try to do the best we can, you know, with the resources available to us.
Right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami's Roman Catholic Archbishop Thomas Wensky about the Trump administration's sudden cancellation of a partnership with Catholic Charities here to aid unaccompanied migrant children, and the growing rift between President Trump and the Catholic Church that looms over it. Archbishop, we have to talk about that rift I just mentioned. You alluded to it earlier. You were on our program last year voicing your and the Catholic Church's deep concern about President Trump's sweeping migrant deportation campaign. This breach between him and the church has only deepened since then. The administration has gone after Catholic Charities in other parts of the country as well, because it accuses the church of supporting open borders to build its Latino flock here, among other charges. Did you expect the Trump retribution, let's say, to reach this level that we're seeing now?
Well, you know, we knew it would be difficult, and we didn't know necessarily how difficult it would be, but it's difficult, and we play with the cards that have been dealt to us. So we try to do our best in all this, but you know, we're hoping that you know, that Trump would listen to his better angels and pivot from a enforcement only strategy for migration to one that would also include a pathway to citizenship or to permanent residency for those who have not committed crimes and those who have been here years, for many years, and have deep ties to this country and have children perhaps that are U.S. citizens or spouses that are U.S. citizens that have property, you know, that have paid taxes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, the president has promised the best economy ever, and if you're going to give us the best economy ever, you're going to have to count on the labor
migrant labor.
Four
years ago, though, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, himself an anti-immigration hawk, said it was, quote, disgusting for you and others to compare today's unaccompanied migrant children to the Cuban Pedro Pan child refugees of the 1960s, the inference being there that the Pedro Pan flight from communism was supposedly a more noble cause. You called that remark from him a, quote, new low in the zero-sum politics of our divisive age. But did it not foreshadow the Trump administration's current posture toward these children that we're talking about today?
Well, I think it did foreshadow it very, very clearly. And again, back then, and I pointed out that the times that I've gone to celebrate Mass, for example, for these children, both at our shelter, at the Brian Walsh shelter, but at the one that was opened up at Homestead Air Force Base that had a couple thousand kids at one time, that when I celebrated Mass, these kids knew the answers to the prayers. they knew the songs. And so these were not street ruffians. These were not street kids, you know, that were swept off the streets of Latin America. These were kids that were coming from families, just like those Cuban kids. And and just as those Cuban parents were driven by desperation to save their kids from communism, the parents that are sending these kids, that sent these kids over, were also acting out of desperation. Maybe not necessarily from communism, but in some cases, yes, but for other reasons. And just as the you know, the Pedro Pan kids could become very successful in this country, because this country does that. We have great freedoms, we have great opportunities, and so there's no reason that that success could not be repeated with this generation of unaccompanied minors.
Now, the new dynamic in all of this is Pope Leo XIV's criticism of President Trump's controversial war in Iran, which drew caustic backlash this week from Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance, including that bizarre meme of the president depicting himself as Jesus Christ. Vance even lectured Pope Leo on theology. So since theology seems to be the debate subject of the week, help us understand the Pope's and the Church's theology on matters such as war and peace that are at the heart of this now.
Well, you know, referring to that meme in which the president seemed to be depicted as a Christ-like figure, I've told people that, you know, as Christians, we're supposed to look like Jesus, not in our costuming, but in our actions. So but the president did take that down from the internet, and so that, I think, represents an indication that perhaps he realized that he maybe had gone too far. But, you know, the Pope is the Pope, and the Pope is supposed to speak about peace and justice. So we expect the Pope to say these things. On Easter Sunday, every Easter Sunday, popes for generations have spoken, given a messages urbe et orbe to the city and to the world. And those messages, very consistently over the years, from one pope to another, you know, calling for peace, calling for the cessation of violence, calling for people to listen to their better angels, and to say there are better ways to achieve one's political ends than through violence and warfare. And so that's what the Pope is saying. And the Catholic Church is not a pacifist. We do recognize that there can be what we call just wars.
Just war, right.
And basically, you know, if the president and or the vice president thinks that what they're doing is just, they should explain it to us and show us why it is so. And we have a framework for doing so, developed by Thomas Aquinas.
Aquinas, all the way back to the 12th century.
By St. Augustine, even by St. Augustine. You know, that you do things, you only resort to violence when it's the last resort, and you try everything else before that. You know, so your reasons for going to war have to be just. Your reasons, what you do in war, also have to be just. The way you fight, you know, it's hard to see that wiping out an entire civilization is a just way of waging war. Now, you know, rather than react, negatively, engage the conversation. And I think that's what the Pope is inviting the world leaders to do when he, you know, he was just in Africa. He's still in Africa.
Still in Africa, right? Yeah.
When he started in Cameroon, he stopped Algeria and Cameroon. In Cameroon, speaking with the president, with the leaders of that country there, spoke strongly about the need to uproot corruption in that country. So, you know, the Pope is supposed to speak truth to power.
Archbishop, unfortunately for time, we'll have to leave it there. The Most Reverend Thomas Wenske is the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Miami. Archbishop, many thanks as always.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, questioning immigration enforcement partnerships with the feds on our college campuses. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. It's been a year since we started seeing partnerships popping up left and right in Florida between local police and federal immigration agencies like ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It was part of President Trump's and Governor DeSantis's aggressive immigration crackdown, and it included ICE agreements with college police, from the University of Florida in Gainesville to Florida International University in Miami. Not surprisingly, though, those campus cop arrangements with the feds angered students and faculty, and they still do. Just yesterday, students from UF and FIU, as well as other Florida schools like Florida State University, mobilized to the state capitol in Tallahassee to demand the end to the so-called 287G agreements. And that demonstration came just days after two FIU professors said in a report on The Conversation that the 287G deal that their immigrant-rich school has students feeling less safe and in a climate of heightened stress and anxiety. As always, we'd like to hear your thoughts about this. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now are those two FIU professors, Anindya Kundu, a professor of educational leadership, and Ryan Pontier, a bilingual education professor. Dr. Kundu, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
As we mentioned yesterday, students from FIU, UF, Florida State, University of Central Florida, and other schools demonstrated in Tallahassee calling for these campus immigration enforcement agreements with ICE to be canceled. It's hard to imagine that happening in the current Florida political climate, but what, as you pointed out in your Conversation article, have you been noticing on campuses like FIU's about the student anxiety that drove yesterday's protest?
Sure. So, plainly put, these policies are somewhat vague. We're waiting to see how they will be enforced, through which mannerisms and mechanisms they will be enforced. But the immediate impact on campus seems to be a chilling effect, where students and faculty are feeling like they can't speak out, that advocating for our rights may lead to some sort of suppression or some sort of disciplinary action. And the resulting climate on campus is one of fear and anxiety related to those uncertainties.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, though, is the fear and anxiety as much about sort of getting retribution for protesting these as much as it is mm-hmm. perhaps getting caught up in immigration arrests?
A little bit of both. So in the article, you know, one of our students graciously gave us a quote where even though she is here by legal means, she mentioned that she was nervous of participating on campus activities, of asking for campus police for help if she were to need help because she could be profiled and targeted as a student whose records could be looked at or whatnot.
Right, and I want to get to that a little bit later in the segment here, Professor Pontier. I'm assuming in your field you work with many international students. Since these 287G agreements were struck with ICE on college campuses here, how significantly has it affected whether students feel welcome at these schools or feel threatened? Do they feel as if the university has their backs, or that in the current political environment, do they feel the administration is more on ICE's side?
With the students that I've been working with, they very much do not feel protected at this point. They feel, I think, more fearful that something might happen to them based on how they look, how they sound, the languages that they're using. And so the police force, instead of being in place for safety, is now something that is really causing them just not to feel like they belong here or like they're actually safe in a space where previously that has been the case.
Mm-hmm. What about, though, that aspect of the question I asked, that, you know, this feeling of whether the administration has their backs or ICE's backs?
From our students' perspective and what we have observed, it really does sound like they believe the administration has ICE's backs, not so much our students' backs.
Mm-hmm. And why do they have that distinct impression, would you say?
There has been no particular policy that we're aware of that has been made in direct support of our international students, students who speak languages other than English. or students who might be told that they don't look like they belong here. There have not been any messages provided to faculty or staff about what we should do should ICE enter a classroom or a building, in what ways we can protect and support our students, and our students are well aware of that.
Okay. Now, I want to play a clip from one of those FIU students, Sonia Stolar, a senior journalism major from Ukraine, who's here on a legal visa. She shared this with us this week.
You feel kind of anxious because your peers who are a part of this community as much as you are, they're more vulnerable now because maybe they didn't have the same opportunities to obtain those documents or the same privileges as you did. And now they're being targeted at an educational establishment where they have every right to be at. And also this level of uneasiness that comes with, you know, we read the news, we see what's happening, and we are dealing with a very unpredictable force that is known to get violent and dehumanizing and unjust in many ways. Understanding and thinking that the administration of our university chooses to have a partnership with this unpredictable force, it's very unfortunate, and you start losing trust.
Now, again, FIU, obviously, I mean, given its name, Florida International University, it is a very international student-oriented place, as well as a campus that's rich with immigrant students. So, Dr. Kundu, how do you see this impacting non-white, non-citizen immigrant or international students who may be here legally, like the young woman we just heard from, but precisely because they are non-white and non-citizens, they feel vulnerable to immigration enforcement action on campus, given what they've seen of ICE's track record over the past year?
Sure. And I think those students have a rightful sense of being nervous and scared and not being sure if they belong on campus. Earlier, you were asking about protests, and our university has been sending mixed messages around which values we adhere to as an institution. So, of course, I'm sure you and your listeners are aware of the racist group chat that FIU students were engaged in.
Right.
I believe it was a college
Republican
school.
For which no students so far have been suspended,
exactly.
according to reports.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a key point worth making in this broader conversation we're having around what is the point of these policies. So no disciplinary action has been taken. These students have been investigated for weeks, and that's basically where we're at. If we were to guess, it would probably be that there will be no sort of disciplinary measure. Now, in contrast to that, about a month ago, we had a presidential event where Alex Rodriguez, the baseball player, was in conversation with our president, Jeanette Nunez, in like a fireside chat. There was a loud protest outside the event where students picketed, and inside, there was a silent demonstration at one point during this conversation where 20 or so students stood up, revealed these shirts that said ICE off FIU. Now, those students were immediately reprimanded outside of the event. They were asked for their names. Faculty tried to intervene and protect and asked if the students were being detained, which they were not at the time. But the university has, in fact, followed up by saying that these students are essentially in the punishment pipeline. They are being investigated to see whether or not they have violated the student code of conduct. And it's a much swifter response with a higher level of scrutiny than in the racist group chat.
Okay.
And so with these sorts of actions and policies, it's not hard for non-white immigrant students to question if they belong here and if their university supports them and sort of these humanitarian values.
Professor Pontier, in this regard, do you feel university officials like FIUs have been transparent enough with these students when it comes to how to act if they see ICE agents crossing their path on campus, for example? Are they getting enough, say, of the counseling resources in that regard they need now that this is a campus reality?
To our knowledge, no, not at all. There's been no direction that has been provided in terms of what the expectations are, either in terms of how they might comport themselves or the protections that they would be given.
Mm-hmm. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Florida International University professors Anindya Kundu and Ryan Pontier about a growing student movement in the state to rescind campus police partnership agreements with federal immigration agencies like ICE. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Dr. Kundu, you've mentioned that you haven't yet seen official reports of immigration arrests of students on the state's college campuses as a result of these so-called 287G agreements, but you are aware of student arrests that have occurred off campus. Is that correct? But in a so, however, can we really tie those to the 287G partnerships with campus police?
Sure. So there are instances of, you know, university and college students being apprehended off various college grounds for violating such and such. That has not necessarily been the case yet on university grounds. And that is a source of, you know, I guess optimism might feel too strong of a word, but it does help us sort of think of campuses as more of a safe haven, which is kind of how we had been positioning them for the previous couple of decades. But it's not clear because, you know, there's a video surfacing of FIU PD saying that if ICE asks us to directly comply with them, we will. So there are these sorts of evidence showing our PD is willing to engage with ICE if requested to do so. So far, that has not actually happened. But just the fact that it doesn't happen doesn't mean that there aren't real effects of this on campus, even if they're symbolic. Mm-hmm. And I think those symbolic kind of consequences are very real in this moment where our institution is kind of proactively aligning itself with a broader, more conservative state and federal agenda to police immigration across public domains.
Mm-hmm. Now, Professor Pontier, one of the important questions you also raise is whether schools like FIU have accompanied these campus police partnerships with federal immigration enforcement with resources like campus legal aid for students who might run afoul of that enforcement. I want to play here an anonymous clip from an FIU international student, a PhD student from Morocco, who spoke with us this week. And I'll mention that we've distorted the pitch of her voice.
When they started that agreement, I was afraid to even go to the classroom and heard about student deportation. And I heard about that first from a student, a classmate. I did have an adverse experience and tried to find justice at the university. But it's very difficult to even report discrimination at this point because this is the climate that we navigate right now. It's been challenging, and the professors expect us to perform as usual.
Now, she told us she's thinking about transferring to another college in a different state. But what stands out most to you, Professor Pontier, in what she's saying there?
It's the lack of feeling safe or trusted, that she is well aware of incidents like the racist group chat, where there essentially has been no punishment or real consequence whatsoever. And then students who have protested in what we know to be legal ways have actually been detained. And so there's no reason for her to feel comfortable. And like, this is an institution that supports her. And so it makes a lot of sense that she wants to go somewhere where she feels like she has the support of all of the people and the resources that are around her.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kundu, now, we should point out, in fairness, that the FIU administration, Jeanette Nunez's administration there, insists that all it's doing is simply letting campus police and federal immigration enforcement enforce valid U.S. immigration law. But I want to just end here with that idea we were talking about before, that perhaps international students who are protesting these agreements, that perhaps they fear also that their visas could be yanked because they took part in this kind of demonstration, the way some international students have had that happen to them because they took part in, say, pro-Palestinian demonstrations mm-hmm. on campus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those consequences seem very real. The stakes for these students are very real. And my question is that why are we so congratulatory of ourselves and patting ourselves on the back for anticipatory compliance. You know, 15 institutions signed on as soon as the governor made this directive. Not one pushed back because they weren't willing to see what would happen if they pushed back. But if they had, then the students would actually feel more supported. Okay. And what are we doing here when we're policing these students who are coming here, not just for a degree, but for skills and for competencies and pathways to upward mobility? Why are we policing this group of people who are going to contribute back more than what they receive. That's what all the
Right.
social science research corroborates, but it's just to align ourselves with this dominant ideology that immigrants are here to take, but all of the facts show that they're here to give more. So
Okay.
we
And
have
our
to push back.
yeah.
And our students are well informed too, right? Because they understand what's happening in context beyond the universities. They've seen the times that ICE has engaged in some overreach and egregious activities. And so it makes sense if they feel the way that they do here on campus.
Okay. Ryan Pontier is an FIU bilingual education professor. Anindya Kundu is a professor of educational leadership, both at Florida International University. Many thanks to you, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Still to come, a new WLRN documentary profiles South Florida as a national model for climate change resilience. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. The populist powers that be today can deny climate change and its man-made causes all they want, but just about any climate scientist on the planet will still tell you it's a reality that's not going away. And it's not going away on WLRN. Next Wednesday, a WLRN-TV original documentary, Facing the Future, South Florida versus Climate Change, will have its broadcast debut on WLRN-TV, Channel 17. The film takes us back to the often harrowing hurricane season of 2024, the year that featured monster storms like Milton and Helene, but also monster rain and flood events that showed just how much more wrathful global warming has made the skies above us and the waters below us. More important, though, Facing the Future profiles South Florida's climate activists and academics, creating a national model for climate change resilience, from raised streets in the Keys to floodplain connectivity in the Everglades. Joining me now is one of the experts featured in the WLRN documentary Facing the Future, Miami Herald chief climate change reporter Alex Harris. Alex, always great to have you on.
Great to be here.
We'd, of course, like to hear your thoughts about climate change resilience here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Alex, I want to start by playing a clip here from the documentary from University of Miami meteorological scientist Nkosi Muse, who is vice chair of the City of Miami Climate Resilience Committee.
We're not unique in the fact that we face sea level rise. We're not unique in the fact that we deal with extreme heat. We're not unique in the fact that it rains a lot, but we are unique in the fact that we're dealing with all those things at the same time, right? So we have heat, hurricane season, flooding, even at times drought, all at the same time.
So Alex, for you, does that sort of sum up why Miami and South Florida should be considered the country's climate change ground zero, and therefore the place that has the duty, let's say, to show the rest of the country how to manage this onslaught? I mean, you also say in the film that what sets South Florida apart in this regard is that, quote, we get to see things, right?
Absolutely. It's the burden of seeing the symptoms of climate change directly in front of our eyes. It's a lot harder to pretend it's not real if you're up to your ankles in flood water when you're outside trying to get your mail. Dr. Close is totally right. We see a lot more of the frontline effects than anyone else down here, and it absolutely changes the politics. You'll see bipartisan climate action is something that happens in South Florida more than it does in other places. You see residents are asking their politicians for flood resilience. At the same time, they're also asking for better parks or more efficient public transportation. It's just a kitchen table issue down here.
Yeah. I mean, even you know, the most conservative Republicans in the state, including Governor DeSantis, are Everglades champions. I mean, it's just it's a reality here. Right.
Absolutely.
As I mentioned, though, the documentary takes us back to 2024, and really one of the most compelling passages in the film isn't about a devastating hurricane, but about the devastating rainstorm we experienced here that summer and how you and the Herald mobilized to cover it. The feeling the viewer gets is that it's not just the big storms that we have to learn to prepare for now, it's also the common cloudburst now that can wreak almost as much havoc. What do we need to start acknowledging about that, especially as it pertains to what we saw, you know, you dealing with in the documentary?
Yeah, I really think this is one of the most important takeaways that anyone who lives in South Florida can draw from what climate change is going to mean for them and what it means now. Hurricanes are horrible. They're big special events, right? We have a really good system in Florida for preparing for them, for getting people out of harm's way, for rebuilding afterwards. We're pretty good at that. We're best in the nation, Florida's response to storms. But what we're not as good at is the rainstorms. They are getting stronger. They are already overwhelming our infrastructure. The roads are just literally not designed to hold that much water. Your homes are too low in some neighborhoods. And there's not that easy, quick call the emergency operations system center, get the money from the federal government to help repair the flood damage. There is not as easy a 1, 2, 3. We know what to
right.
do.
And Alex, just quickly explain to scientific lay people like me why the common rainstorm has become so much stronger, powerful, etc.
Absolutely. I mean, if you live in South Florida, you felt it. When you go outside on a humid day, the air feels thick. Hot air can hold more moisture.
Yeah.
So as the atmosphere bakes, it's easier to squeeze more rain out of clouds. So those rainstorms are truly getting stronger. It's something we can visually see and track in the last couple decades.
Right. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Continue that important thought you were making before.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the kind of stuff that we really need to start preparing for as a community. And Miami has taken some great strides. South Florida, has made some efforts to respond to that kind of flooding because we don't have the muscle memory yet as a federal government. We're not where we need to be in the same way we are for once a year or once every few year hurricane preps. But these rainstorms, I mean, we all know what happens on 95 in Biscayne when it rains in Brickell or downtown. You see cars flooding once or twice a summer.
Yeah.
It's really an issue that needs more attention down here. And I think local governments are trying to address it, but we're not there yet.
Now, you also say in the film that we're, quote, at an inflection point in this struggle with climate change. There's a moment when you recite for us in the film the remarkable temperature data we're seeing these days that's driving so much of this. Tell us about that and other reasons why you feel we're at that inflection point now.
Yeah, these numbers always get me. In 1960, Miami had about 85 days a year where it felt like it was over 90 degrees. Right about now, we're seeing about 133 days. And by 2050, if business as usual, we could see 187 days a year that feel like they're over 90 degrees. That's more than half the year.
More than half the year, yeah. Oh, God.
It's crazy. I mean, that's hot weather to wait for a bus outside or do yard work, or if you work outside, God forbid, that gets dangerous to be outside when it's that hot. This is something that, you know, it's not a problem for the future. It's a problem for right now. And we've profiled right. many people who are experiencing it in their day-to-day lives.
And I would imagine that has economic consequences in the sense that why come to Florida in February when it's no different than July?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people don't visit Boston in January. They might stop visiting Miami in August if we really, it gets miserable to be outside.
Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Miami Herald climate change reporter Alex Harris, who's featured in a new WLRN original documentary titled Facing the Future, South Florida versus Climate Change, which debuts on WLRN-TV next Wednesday. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Alex, what is South Florida doing as a community of activists and scientists now that stands out in terms of building this national model of climate change resilience that the documentary sees emerging here? One of the scientists in it remarks that here we're seeing an unusual level of, quote, social cohesion when it comes to resilience solutions. Can you give us some examples of what the film talks about there?
Yeah, absolutely. So Miami is not well known for having the largest community of activists compared to other major cities in the U.S. But what this smaller community down here does have is they are really, they work together. They advocate for similar issues from Miami-Dade County, from the cities. We see things like asking for a climate emergency resolution. We see people talking about making sure that there are floodplain changes, that can we have parks that absorb more water? Can we pay more attention? Can we add more solar? There are community groups that work together to try to advocate for all the same solutions here. And it's a lot stronger than having five different groups asking for five different things.
Mm-hmm. Now, two of the examples that stood out for me was this idea of connectivity. And you mentioned, you know, how do we create spaces that serve as sponges, you know, for water. But I was really intrigued that, you know, we talk about Everglades restoration, for example, so much as having to do with, you know, our water supply. But it also, the film also talked about how we use the Everglades as this connectivity, a floodplain connectivity mechanism that can also help us mitigate. I was intrigued by that, but again, I'm a layperson. Can you explain a little bit about how that works?
Absolutely. So yeah, the all of our drinking water comes from the Everglades. So we need water to flow south through there. We need rain to fall over there and recharge it, so we've got nice, clean drinking water. But we also want that water to stay over there. We do not want it encroaching on West Miami-Dade into our neighborhood. So there are really great changes that can be made of how canals are designed, how the big plots of land that can serve as a buffer. Wetlands are really important. The whole, like the line of development versus wildlife on the edge boundaries of the county. The more space we have, the more room there is to soak up that water and recharge the aquifer for us, but also to, you know, serve as a holding spot, like the ditch in front of your house that holds the water so it doesn't come into your front yard. Yeah. The Everglades is can definitely serve as one of those answers, and it's really being looked at now as a climate solution instead of just an environmental restoration project.
Right. Now, one of the other examples that I found, and you and I have discussed this on this show before, the idea, and you know, like we're seeing in Miami Beach, projects like this, raised streets, seawalls, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. But the documentary pointed out that this is really, really urgent in the Keys, right?
Oh, yeah. There are places in the Keys, still Wright Point, which was highlighted in the documentary, that have seen more than 100 days in a row where streets are underwater from flooding. Wow. This is something residents have been begging for solutions for years, but these projects are really expensive and they're also really controversial, and they're not happening as fast as scientists and government workers say they need to.
All right. Now, one of the things the documentary also drives home, and you sort of alluded to it a couple of minutes ago, is that all the work the climate scientists are doing, all the important work the climate scientists are doing in South Florida has to be complemented and is being complemented by the work of citizen activists like the Clio Institute and the artist-led Cortada Foundation, not to mention journalists like yourself. From your standpoint as a climate change journalist here, do you agree with that point the documentary makes?
Yeah, I mean, something, I watched the documentary for the first time last night, and what I was struck by was not, you know, the great good work that folks are doing, but when the camera panned to the crowd, it's nice to see how many people show up to these events because they care. People who go to Clio events, go to Cortada events, who are in the audience because they care and they really want to be a part of the solution. I think that's something that is always really nice to see, and something these groups are really good at mobilizing groups of people. I mean, you could always have more, but it is really good to see that they're reaching a diverse group of people to share the idea that we could all be part of solutions.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the start of the documentary, though, Alex, you say flat out, quote, "I worry that we're not moving fast enough." If so, what do we have to do to move faster on this here and around the country and around the world, for that matter?
Well, we're clearly not moving fast enough if people are still getting their homes and cars flooded multiple times a year in South Florida, right, seeing their property values change or their insurance prices go up. I think we need to get our engineering solutions in order faster. I mean, adaptation is something South Florida is already leading the country on and really could do an even better job of. And the federal and the state government has done a really good job with the Resilient Florida Grant Program of really supercharging that in Florida, $1 billion over the last few years, helping local governments build pumps and pipes and hire roads. I just think we need to see, you know, shovels in the ground a little faster. These projects need to, these seawalls need to get higher quicker.
Right. But one point, though, that I don't think the documentary did bring up is that one thing that I think we don't experience as badly as, say, the Gulf Coast experiences in storms for hurricanes is storm surge. Mm-hmm. Is that something that perhaps we need to have the Gulf Coast scientists showing us how to confront?
Oh, absolutely. Storm surge is definitely an issue here, too. Just ask anybody who lived in some of the coastal communities after Hurricane Irma. But it's way larger of an issue and much more serious of an issue on the Gulf Coast. But it doesn't mean that the solutions they come up with can't be something we adapt and start to use here. And doesn't mean that the science we do here can't work there as well.
All right. Alex Harris is the Miami Herald's chief climate change reporter. You can see the debut of WLRN's original documentary, Facing the Future, South Florida versus Climate Change, on WLRN-TV Channel 17 next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Alex, many thanks as always.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, writing an ode to your postal code. Is there a more South Florida thing? It's Zipode season, our annual partnership with the O Miami Poetry Festival, when we invite you to write an ode to your zip code in April, National Poetry Month. The rules are simple. Use your 5-digit zip code to write a 5-line poem. Each digit of your zip code determines how many words per line, like this.
This is Piero Joseph Filpi. I currently live in Miami. I'm from Miami. And my zip ode today is from 33141. Surging houses lean over the bay and will be swallowed whole someday.
And like this.
My name is Liza. I live in 33133, which is Coconut Grove. Golf carts, mokes, robots abruptly stop when, flag, a smiley kid crosses the street.
Still need help? We have you covered. We built a Zipode tool to help you at WLRN.org/Zipodes. The Zipodes finale event this year is on Wednesday, April 29th at 6 p.m. at Vizcaya Museum and Gardens in Miami. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening, as always. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN.